from KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. In her new book on how to battle the Donald Trump presidency, No is Not Enough, activist and author Naomi Klein writes, Trump is a mirror held up not only to the United States, but to the world. She'll join us to discuss what ails the U.S., what to do about it, and why she's so worried about what might happen if a major crisis meets President Trump's rapid-fire approach to lawmaking. Join our conversation with Naomi Klein. It's coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Author and activist Naomi Klein has spent decades studying and writing about corporate power, climate change, and politics, including how politicians exploit national crises to push through controversial policies. Naomi Klein is the award-winning author of No Logo and The Shock Doctrine, and she says Donald Trump's ascendance is a symptom of private wealth's oversized influence in politics. In her new book, No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need, she urges the left to stop pointing fingers about the 2016 election and instead move on to set an agenda for change. And we welcome her to this first hour of Forum. Glad to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Glad to be back.
Well, let's begin with really the warning that you're setting out here. I mean, you do have some answers as to what to do, but you pretty much established Donald Trump as not necessarily an aberration, but more a logical extension of the worst of the past half century, perhaps. But what you express, it seems to me, as a kind of imperative as well as a warning is we're going to have a shock up ahead, whether it's terrorist act, whether it's economic meltdown, whatever. I mean, this has been sort of a motif of your work. And this is an administration that would probably try to capitalize, I would use the word, not even necessarily in quotes, on that, not only in terms of profit,
literally
in terms of profit and corporatization and corporate values, but also authoritarianism. So the danger is power and profit both with respect to something shocking that citizens may not be prepared for.
Well, that's one of the things that I am particularly worried about, and it's one of the reasons why I really rushed out this book at a speed that is not the way I usually write books. My previous books took, on average, 5 years to write, and this book took 5 months. And you know, thanks to publishers who felt passionately as I did that we really did need to get this out, because as shocking as Trump himself is, and we lots of people use this word shock to describe the state that they're in as they face this tsunami of executive orders and this every day brings some new shocking news, whether it's Comey's firing or some palace drama or other Capitol Hill testimony of top officials. What we haven't seen is what this administration would do if they had a major external shock to exploit, not the shocks that Trump himself is generating, but something like a market crash like we saw in 2008 or a major disaster like Katrina.
Not the daily shocks that we've become heir to, but something major you're talking about.
Yeah, that is external to this administration. Trump's already shown his willingness to exploit disasters in other countries, right? After the Manchester, this horrific Manchester terrorist attack, Trump immediately said, this is about immigrants streaming across our borders. Never mind that the bomber in that case was born in the UK. On the night of the London Bridge terror attacks, he went on this tweet storm attacking the mayor of London, but also saying, this is why we need our Muslim travel ban, which he had denied was a travel ban. So, you know, what I do in the book is describe what I call the toxic to-do list, because, as you know, we've seen a lot of dangerous things from this administration, but there's yet more that Trump has openly said he'd like to do, right? Ban entry to the country from all Muslims. He said he wants to fill up Guantanamo. He said he wants to bring back torture because it works. So I'm not engaging in any kind of conspiracy theory here. I'm just taking the president at his tweets and looking at the conditions under which he might be able to ram through this agenda if we aren't ready.
You're also talking about the Trump brand in this book, and you talk about him as a brand breeder and a super brander and all that, and certainly most would agree that that is indeed the case. But in many ways, you say he looks at us as consumers, and he doesn't necessarily traverse the line between voters and consumers, that we meld into kind of one in his mind, and therefore we can be used and we can be exploited, and indeed we are. I mean, the argument essentially, I think, is that as far as the Trump administration is concerned, we're part of the consumerville.
Well, you know, I really think in a very real sense, the U.S. government has become an extension of the Trump brand. And, you know, this is really unprecedented territory, in part because the business model that Trump has adopted and has organized his life and his family around, lives and breathes at every stage, is a relatively new business model, right? It emerged in the as recently as the 1990s, and this was the subject of my first book, No Logo, where companies stopped seeing themselves as primarily in the business of selling products and marketing them, and started to see themselves primarily as marketers who happened to have products that were marketing tools, right? So Trump really doesn't build buildings anymore. He sells the Trump name to others as a marketing tool, right? So everything that builds his brand, that builds his profile, that reinforces the meaning of his brand, which is power through wealth, absolute power through wealth, his brand as the ultimate boss, living the dream, who can do whatever he wants to whoever he wants. And what better stage to enact that than the White House, right? Which really has become this kind of performance space for him.
But there's a real indictment here of well, the lack of awareness, perhaps, of the citizenry, because you say it's based on our identity, on what we buy or do, as opposed to what we believe.
Well, this whole phenomenon of what is called lifestyle branding emerged at a time when, in the 90s, which was the peak of the market fundamentalist period, where Margaret Thatcher said there is no such thing as society, just individual men and women and families. And what that was reflecting was a political and ideological project that was waging war on the collective sphere, on public institutions of all kinds. So one of the effects that had is that many of the institutions where we used to derive our group identity, which is a deep human impulse, you know, wanting to be part of a tribe, wanting to be part of something larger than ourselves, a lot of those institutions were collapsing. And then along came the lifestyle brands, the Nikes and the Starbucks and the Apples, selling not just products, but belonging in this tribe, in this tribe that you become part of through consumption. And that's what Trump has done with his base. But he has done it in a way of marketing this idea that we live in a world, and it's absolutely true, of big winners and a whole lot of losers in the economic sense. Now, Trump doesn't want to fix that. His promise to his tribe is, I'm going to turn you into a winner, right? That's why the worst thing Trump can say to you is that you're a loser, right? The first shot in the first episode of Apprentice was panned over a homeless man sleeping in the street, and then panned over to Trump in his limousine. And the implicit question is, who do you want to be, the homeless man or Donald Trump, who steps on everybody to get to where he's where he wants to go? And so this is what he's been selling through self-help books, through Trump's so-called university, through The Apprentice, this promise of being in that winner circle, and which is even sweeter because of all the people you step on along the way. And this is where his denigration of others, whether immigrants, whether disabled people, Black people, is such a key part of his brand. And so when Trump is attacked, because he has this relationship of belonging and aspiration with his voters, with his base, when he's attacked, they feel attacked because their relationship is kind of tribal.
Talking with Naomi Klein, her new book is No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. Those people who are the purchasers, the buyers of the Trump brand, I mean, we had Joan Williams on recently, a Hastings law professor who's written a great deal about gender, and she said not only do they identify with that wealth, but to a great extent, the poor are being helped and immigrants are being helped. They're not being helped, so they feel that Trump is somehow going to be their savior as well, or their messianic figure.
Well, I don't know if Oh, so they have that perception,
And
certainly that has been the way...
That's what's been sold to them, and that's what they bought.
That's what's been sold to them, and that is the way in which attacks on the public sphere have been sold in the United States since Reagan and the whole welfare queens myth, right? This idea that public services are being used and abused and exhausted by people of color, and erasing the fact that it is actually majority white people who benefit from food stamps and other social services. But this politics of racial division, of using race as a wedge, has been the most potent tactic for imposing this hypermarket ideology, which hurts the vast majority of Americans. You need a tool, and the tool in the United States is race.
You used the C word before. I just wanted conspiracy. And, you've often been confused going all the way back to your anti-global movement involvement. We'll talk about that perhaps, of conspiracy theories.
But we weren't anti-global.
I'm sorry. Anti-globalism.
Anti-corporate.
Anti-corporate globalism. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that semantic distinction.
We like the world.
Well, in fact, you say the world we need. But somebody, who's the we in here? Military spending and climate change, a lot of these are seen kind of in a connectedness as a gestalt of sorts because they essentially enhance corporate wealth. They enhance corporate privateering. I mean, this is sort of the thesis that you've been working with. And it does sound in some ways, like when you say, for example, there's palace intrigue between Steve Bannon and Jared Kushner, that may be so, but they're on the same side in terms of wanting to bring down agencies and enhance corporate wealth. It suggests as if there's a kind of corporate wealth power that dictates and that controls.
Well, look, the idea that this is somehow conspiratorial at this stage in history just baffles me, right? The mask is completely off. He appointed the CEO of Exxon to be Secretary of State. He has five former Goldman Sachs executives in his cabinet after running a campaign explicitly targeting Goldman Sachs and accusing Ted Cruz and Hillary Clinton of being in the pocket of Goldman Sachs. The revolving door is gone. It's like they've just cut out the middleman,
Don't forget the generals, because they're pretty central in this administration.
Absolutely. Generals who have, in some cases, gone directly from jobs at General Dynamics to Secretary of Defense and other high-up positions in the Trump administration. So, I think what really sets this administration apart, because this isn't new, is just the shamelessness of it, right? Not having any veneer that there is a separation between the most powerful corporations in the United States and the people in government, and Trump himself in his complete shamelessness and unwillingness to divest himself from his business, and just saying, I've separated myself because my kids are running it. And Ivanka saying, I've separated myself from my brand because my brother and sister-in-law are running it. I mean, they're thumbing their nose and they're really laughing, I think, at people, because this is the most shameless thing we've ever seen.
Well, we do have right now legislation or a lawsuit Democrats have brought. We also have at least investigation perhaps going on by Robert Mueller about emoluments and about investments, if we can ever see those tax returns, which is probably unlikely. But nevertheless, All of this seems to be moving him in a different direction, as well as checks and balances. He didn't get, the immigration ban through, for example, with executive order. And some who are hopeful can say there's real resistance, there's real pushback that's going on, and it's not necessarily going to go in his favor. Although it's true, calling for a boycott, really, aren't you?
No, look, I think that there have been incredible victories, and the resistance has been really inspiring. The pushback on the travel ban, most of all, I think that people instantly coming together, going to airports, emboldening local politicians to step up, emboldening Democrats to step up, I think emboldening the courts to step up. This is exactly what we need. But what I'm trying to focus on is, let's not forget that happened without severe state repression. I mean, they let those protests go ahead. And what I'm saying is, if there's a Manchester-like attack in the United States, we have to understand that they could very well declare a state of emergency, say that protests are a threat a threat to national security. And there has to be a strategy. We have to cast our minds to that scenario and not just be complacent and say, the resistance is winning. The other thing I would say is that I think they may well get through an extraordinarily regressive piece of healthcare legislation, an extraordinarily regressive piece of tax so-called reform that is a huge corporate giveaway, giving corporations a 15% flat tax, getting rid of the estate tax.
And the two are linked because if they get the healthcare bill they want through, it's going to only enhance the wealth of the wealthy in corporate world.
Absolutely. And then, you know, they're busily working to get rid of Dodd-Frank, which is, you know, the piece of legislation that is attempting to protect us from a repeat of 2008. Many of us criticized it for not being strong enough, but it's clear that Goldman Sachs and other banks, thought it was too strong and they're trying to get rid of it. So that agenda is proceeding apace. And I think I think we can't be sanguine with this idea that everything around Trump is chaos and the resistance is beating him at every front. I don't think Mitch McConnell has ever had it so good, because the Trump show and the relentless media focus on all of the Trump scandals and all of the Trump investigations is providing cover for them to push.
They can call it fake news, which they do, of course. First of all, I mean, in terms of things that are revealed about corruption or things that are revealed about any kind of peculations or things along those lines, they can just say, and they do say, fake news.
But it isn't. I mean, you mentioned that lawsuit about the emolument clause, and it's, you know, as you know from the book, I was revising it up until May. But I do have a mention of that, of the original lawsuit, which was a Washington restaurant that started that a lawsuit saying that they're being discriminated against because Trump's businesses are being favored by foreign governments, and other people who want to ingratiate themselves to Trump in Washington are favoring his businesses because it's clear that this is the way to Donald Trump's heart is through his wallet. But when I finished the book, this much more significant lawsuit of 190 Congress people suing the president, alleging that he's violating the Constitution, I mean, that lawsuit really could go somewhere, because what the Constitution says is that he needs to, if he's going to take gifts from foreign governments, he needs to get the approval of Congress. So they're parties to this. They're the people he should have gotten permission from suing him. So they have a direct interest. And we also have two states' attorneys general, D.C. and Maryland, that have similarly launched lawsuits.
Wouldn't you also like to see a real mobilization, though, of resistance, of a populist mobilization, almost like Trump was able to succeed in doing in terms of people on the right, or people who he appealed to who are even in the center and maybe even some on the left? But the reality is, you know, I was just thinking as I was reading your book, thinking about the Occupy movement, mm-hmm. and anti-globalization movement, what's happened most recently in Georgia. Where's the hope in this? I mean, of mobilizing people?
Well, the reason why I called the book No Is Not Enough is I think, you know, these resistance struggles are crucial. You know, we have to say no to these very dangerous policies that Trump is trying to push through. But even if we were to win every single defensive battle, we would still be, best case scenario, standing exactly where we were before Trump showed up. And that was the ground on which Donald Trump managed to eke out an electoral victory. So looking at what just happened in Georgia, I mean, I think this is a repeat of a similar failed electoral strategy that we saw in 2016 of trying to appeal to moderate Republicans, running a campaign that is largely about rejecting Trump, not putting forward a positive agenda, a plan that is addressing people's daily needs, daily emergencies, need for good jobs, need for universal health care, need for good schools. There just wasn't enough on offer. And so, you know, I think this is a moment that has to be a wake-up call for Democrats to seize back the ground of economic populism. Yes, I believe in social movements, but I think at this point in history, there also has to be a option on the ballot that can compete with this fake populism and this toxic populism that is surging on the right.
Naomi Klein, our guest again, her new book, No Is Not Enough. And looking at New York Times Sunday, there's a picture of you. It says Naomi Klein is sick of benevolent billionaires, interviewed by Anna Marie Cox. Let's talk about this for a moment, because there are those, in fact, Daniel Callahan had an article about this recently in New York Times, and he said, I'm ambivalent about the fact that philanthropy is picking up the pace, that billionaires like Bill Gates, who hire very good people to deal with education questions and AIDS questions and so forth, nevertheless are maybe wielding too much influence. That seems to be, again, kind of a warning signal that you're setting out. But in fact, you seem to have some enmity against billionaires. Even Mark Zuckerberg, you said, heaven forbid at one point, you know, he should be president. I think he may be thinking along those lines. But
it seems to be.
You know, you got Lansing, Michigan. You got Flint, and you got a problem with the water, and the philanthropists, they step up. And so what do you do about the fact that when infrastructure can't be there, when the democratic process can't work and the revenues aren't there and the resources aren't there, philanthropists will often pay those bills?
So I'm not critical of philanthropy. This is not the point I was making in that interview or that I make in the book. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to follow the roads that lead to Trump. Because I think there's been so much attention on his extraordinarily bizarre personality and all of the extremes that he represents that it gives us this idea that if we were just rid of Trump, everything would be fine, right? But how is it that he was able to take power despite having absolutely no qualifications? He made this pitch to American voters. I'm so rich. I've run the successful company. Obviously, that's debatable whether it's successful or not, but he's managed to survive his various bankruptcies and still end up on top. And that is evidence of his success in his world. So he's made this pitch, you know, my wealth and my ability to run a business, it means that you can trust me to run the U.S. government. So where did this idea come from? And the argument I make in the book is you can't understand that without understanding the role of the Davos class, of the Clinton Global Initiative, of figures like Bill Gates, right? The problem is not philanthropy. The problem is that Bill Gates has more power over U.S. schools than the Secretary of Education in many cases.
Well, he has more wealth than most sovereign states. I mean,
How did he get so wealthy? I think we are already outsourcing a great many of the problems that we used to address democratically, transparently, collectively through government to what some people call philanthrocapitalists. And it's the power that I'm questioning, not the philanthropy itself.
Again, we're spending this hour with Naomi Klein, and her new book is called No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. And I know many of you would like to weigh in here, and so let me give you an opportunity to express yourself and join this conversation with any questions or comments you might have. You can join us by calling our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. And again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also post comments on our website or our Facebook page or email us at kqedtalk@gmail.com. That's a new email address. Mark it down, kqedtalk@gmail.com. And we'll continue and we'll hear from you when we return. Much more, of course, we haven't even talked about climate change, which has always been a major concern and major passion, obviously, and crusade, one might add, for Naomi Klein, and how this ties into perhaps the whole picture that we're getting from her here. But we'll talk with you when we return, so please feel free to join the program. And again, you can join us now toll-free at 866-733-6786. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Naomi Klein, who is with us in studio. She's senior correspondent for The Intercept and author most recently of No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. And we are going to bring our callers and our emailers into this. And again, you can join us by calling us or emailing us or going to our Facebook page or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. I did want to talk about Paris with Naomi Klein, though, and she does write about it, and she does have strong, as I said, sentiments about it. We recently had, some of you may have heard us talking to Paul Hawken, who said, you know, this is an opportunity in many ways for much more to be invested in climate change that could make a difference. And he's talking about reversing climate change and really getting a mobilization of people and so forth. Do you see it that way?
Well, we have to. You know, we have no choice. We're out of time. I have the chapter in the book on climate change is called The Climate Clock Strikes Midnight, right? And this is the one of the really terrifying aspects of the Trump presidency is that it arrives at the worst possible moment in human evolution when we need this leap forward when it comes to climate action. And here he is doing everything he can to push us backwards. The good news is that key decisions about where we get our energy, whether we're going to get it from fossil fuels or whether we're going to get it from renewables, how we live in cities, whether we're going to build cities for automobiles or whether we're going to build the best possible, most affordable public transit. These decisions are not made in Washington. I mean, yes, Washington has influence and he's doing his best. He's cutting funding for rail and transit and so on. But cities can step up. States can step up, and I think his belligerence in the face of the Paris Climate Accord, this outrageous press conference in the Rose Garden, saying he's going to get a better deal. You know, the deal that we had in Paris was not good enough, but it was 25 years in the making.
But let me ask you about that, because actually a lot of conservatives said, well, it was non-binding. America had to put up a lot of money without congressional approval. In other words, you do hear this argument.
It wasn't that much money.
Well, but you do hear this argument. In other words, it was a bad deal.
It was a bad deal because it was voluntary. It was non-binding. Yeah. And this is because largely of influence of the U.S. It was because
Czar lobbying.
You're lobbying, lobbying by the fossil fuel industry, and also the fact that the Obama administration felt that if it were a binding treaty, then they would have to bring it back to Congress and the Senate and get it ratified. And with Republicans in control, that wouldn't happen. So they were the ones making sure that it was so weak that a figure like Trump could walk in and just say, well, forget it. We're going to walk away, right? You can't do that for a binding treaty. So that was always the biggest problem. The biggest problem were the mechanisms, the goal in the Paris Accord of trying to keep warming, temperature increase to below 2 degrees and striving to keep it below 1.5 degrees Celsius. That's a good goal. The problem was that we didn't have a binding plan to get there. So governments were allowed to just bring their best efforts. And if you add up those best efforts, and in the U.S., the best efforts centered around Obama's Clean Power Plan, a retirement of old coal-fired power plants primarily, if you add up all those best efforts, it doesn't lead to the goal of keeping temperatures below 1.5 or 2 degrees. It puts us on a road to twice that level of warming. And then Trump arrives and says, well, I'm going to undo the Clean Power Plan. So whether he had stayed or left the Paris Accord, it would have been equally damaging from an emissions perspective. But by making this really outrageous statement, by thumbing, his nose or raising his middle finger to the world, I think he provoked more ambition from other governments and also from governments inside the U.S. My favorite example of this is, the mayor of Pittsburgh. After Trump says, I was elected by the people of Pittsburgh, not the people of Paris, he says, well, actually, Pittsburgh voted for Hillary and we're going to get to 100% renewable energy in Pittsburgh by 2035, which is a very ambitious target. So that's the kind of ambition that we need to see. We need to see, in all the areas that Trump does not control, we need to see visionary leadership. And that relates to climate change. It also relates, frankly, to demilitarizing police. There was a meeting here in the Bay Area, a Berkeley City Council meeting last night, went late into the night to debate whether or not Berkeley is going to continue to participate in Urban Shield, which is part of this very, very dangerous process of a hyper-militarization of the police. The kind of thing I'm worried about in a moment of shock is seeing these militarized police descending on waging war on dissent and protests in this country, and so we need cities like Berkeley and San Francisco, Oakland to be beacons for another way.
You need local energy, leadership. You need
renewable energy,
visionary leadership.
Demilitarized police, sanctuary cities. Whatever power cities and states have right now, we need you to use them.
And that counters what you call, and I like this phrase, the dystopian fiction of Donald Trump. But also you're talking about a bold counterplan to fight for a different model, really, aren't you?
I am. And I think that, while Trump is in power, that other model is going to start at the local level. It's going to start at the subnational level and at the municipal level. And I should add about Urban Shield that, unfortunately, the Berkeley City Council not only voted to stay in Urban Shield, but then there was severe police repression of protesters, of demonstrators, of demonstrating exactly why it is so dangerous to have militarized police, and obviously most dangerous for communities of color who have been most targeted.
Let's bring our callers in, and let me begin with Michael, who is joining us. Michael, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me on. My question is for Ms. Klein about, first, I completely agree with your point that Democrats need a new strategy going forward. And if the special elections and even the election last year has taught us anything, it's that, you know, maybe America's not buying what Democrats are selling so much. And there's other things going on. But my question is this. With the factionalizing of the Democratic Party now, and I'd say the Sanders progressivist left and the more Rahm Emanuel-esque center left, where do you think that new strategy is going to come from? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Naomi Klein.
I think it's a great question. There obviously is a battle going on for the soul of the party. What I am advocating that people do is organize sort of parallel to this process, and come together, draft visionary, bold people's platforms coming out of movements like the Movement for Black Lives, the Fight for 15, the Dreamers, the Climate Justice Movement, all of the movements that are providing the visionary resistance in this moment, come together and elaborate a real platform, build power behind it so that any politician who wants to run for whatever the opposition party is has to sign on to that platform. I mean, this is kind of the Tea Party model, right, where there was a parallel process of saying this is what we're, any Republican who wants our vote has to follow these rules. And, I actually think that progressives can learn from that.
Well, you saw that to some extent in the Bernie Sanders support. I mean, yeah. You saw a kind of burgeoning that was moving toward what the Tea Party was in the Democratic Party, but it split the Democratic Party in ways that had never been heralded or even realized before.
Well, you know, this is happening everywhere, frankly, and we can't be afraid of conflict. We can't. This is a real conflict. This is a battle for the soul of the party. There are very powerful people within the Democratic Party who have benefited from this very centrist neoliberal model. Unfortunately, elections in this country are so outrageously expensive and getting more expensive every time. And
so we just $50 million in Georgia.
Right. And so who's going to fund that? It's going to require getting money from the corporations who need to be confronted with better policy, redistributive policies to pay for the offer, to pay for universal health care, to pay for getting rid of student debt, getting rid of tuition fees. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn in the UK just surged in this election. You know, he didn't win, but he came closer than anybody imagined. The Theresa May's government is very fragile right now. Jeremy Corbyn could yet end up being the PM. This surprised everybody. But what the real turning point was Jeremy Corbyn putting out this visionary manifesto, this platform that had as its centerpiece refunding universal public health care, getting rid of tuition fees, a rapid transition to 100% renewables, welcoming refugees, an acknowledgement that the war on terror paradigm has failed. I mean, it was a very, very bold platform. And what's important for Americans to understand is that Jeremy Corbyn was fought by the elites in the Labour Party at every stage. They tried to unseat him. They staged a coup. They resisted his leadership. But they fought and they won. This isn't going to come easily because there's real money at stake.
Let me bring another caller on. Miriam joins us. Miriam, welcome. Miriam, are you there? One more time. Miriam. Is Alan on the air here with us?
Yes, I'm sorry. On the air.
Go ahead.
I think Ms. Klein made the most important point she's made this morning is the fact that there's really going on. I mean, all of these issues are important, but the media, and I don't care whether it's liberal or conservative, is focusing on these tweets and outrageous statements. And in the meantime, you have health care behind closed doors. You have exactly, you know, Dodd-Frank going on. You have things going on with the EPA, the banks. And I don't understand why the media doesn't start screaming louder about these types of things rather than slicing and dicing every tweet.
All right, Alan, thank you for that. Let's get a response from Naomi Klein.
Well, all I would say, Alan, is I think that wherever you get your news, let them know that you feel they have their priorities backwards, because media outlets need to hear from their listeners, their viewers, to get that message. Right now, what is driving this is ratings. News organizations, whether it is liberal or whether it is conservative, the news media has the best ratings they've had ever because people are addicted to the Trump show. And they are telling themselves that this is what their viewers want. They think they're going to lose viewers if they focus on health care instead of on the various Trump investigations and the various Trump outrages. And the irony is, this is exactly the kind of logic that gave us Trump, right? After the election, we heard all these mea culpas, you know, from CNN and other news networks that they gave Trump too much airtime, right? Because why? Because of their ratings. So, you know, this is a deeply
political. They live or die by ratings. And the reality is, I mean, if they get wonky, they do lose listeners or viewers. I'm talking about particularly the commercial realm more than mm-hmm. the public broadcasting.
Well, I don't know if you can still hear me or not.
I can hear you. We can hear you.
You can?
Yeah, go ahead.
In my career, I was in radio business and television, sales and sales management, and sold all news radio for many years. And, you know, it sounds terrible, but we used to have a saying when the ratings series came up, boy, it would be nice if there were a plane crash.
And, yeah. You know, okay, Alan, let me thank you for that call. I think you've certainly put things into perspective here. But I do want to get Miriam on here. Miriam, go ahead.
Oh, hello. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Go ahead, please.
Wonderful. Ms. Klein, I'm a longtime admirer of your work. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on Arlie Hochschild's book, Strangers in Their Own Land. I just finished it last night. And you know, when you talk about places like San Francisco or Oakland or progressive places needing to be a beacon, it seems that there's a surprisingly large number of people for whom those beacons are repugnant. And so I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on her take on the deep story.
Yeah, I don't know that Naomi has read, and I haven't read the Hochschild book, but I think, as I understand it. Yeah, no, I'm a great admirer of Arlie Hochschild's, but you just read so many books. She was on the program, in fact, on Friday with Mina Kim during the Friday show, so it's in our archives. But, you know, Hillbilly Elegy, a lot of these books have pointed out that Trump appeals to something in people aside from what you're talking about, you know, which is the wealth and the brand and so forth. There's something about him that says, the hell with PC, and I don't have to answer to anybody, and I'm an independent, and and they identify with that in a very strong way. They identify with the xenophobia, many people do. They identify with the racism and the sexism and misogyny. I mean, we have a candidate who talks about, you know, grabbing women by their genitals and all that sort of thing, and people almost think that's funny.
Well, it's this promise of a return to dominance, right? And I think he's appealing to people who feel a loss of status and security on multiple fronts, right? And some of it is wholly illegitimate, right? I mean, it is about restoring dominance for white men, dominance over other people.
That's really what Make America Great Again means, doesn't it?
Going backwards. But it's also, it's mixing in with that, this economic insecurity of our age, right? And, you know, Trump did not win the vote of the poorest people in the country. We know that, right? His base is solidly middle class, but yet what the polling shows is that he did get 77% of the vote of people who said that they've lost economic security status over the past 4 years, right? So they may not be the poorest, but they feel themselves to be losing, and they feel themselves to be losing on multiple fronts, right? Some of it, you know, I think people do have a right to some economic security, and some of the loss of status is wholly illegitimate based on this idea that there is a right to dominance over people of color, over women. And so Trump sort of mixes it up and stirs. And so this is, you know, You know, I don't think that Democrats should be worrying about how they're going to win the racist vote and how they're going to win the misogynist vote. But they can, I believe, get some of the folks who voted for Trump for economic reasons, who did vote for Obama in 2008 and 2012 and didn't see an offer or anything to believe in. And the other thing that the Democrats can do is energize people who don't vote, which is more than who voted for either of the major candidates in this country. And once again, to talk about what just happened in the UK, Jeremy Corbyn's surge, a great deal of it had to do with getting young people to vote who traditionally do not vote and registering them. And, you know, this is where I think a key to electoral success in this country is going to be. But there has to be a tangible offer.
Well, the Democrats took it for granted that somehow the young people who backed Barack Obama and the people of color, particularly African-Americans who backed Barack Obama, would come aboard because they were carrying on the Obama legacy. And to a great extent, those folks were not necessarily brought in the way they were by Obama. But
because Trump was appealing to real and right, I think well-earned cynicism about the political class in Washington, having had hopes raised and seen their standard of living slide. And obviously, this is not just white people. The people who lost the most after the 2008 financial crisis were Black people, because they were the people who were targeted, specifically targeted for subprime mortgages.
Let me read some comments here and get your response. Again, we're talking to Naomi Klein. Her new book is No Is Not Enough. And Tina, my producer, reminds me that Arlie Hochschild also writes about how this community we're talking about is also incredibly resilient and welcoming to outsiders in Louisiana, which is where she focuses on Louisiana Republicans. So Ben asks, what does your guest think about identity politics and its outsized role in the current Democratic Party? Shouldn't the left move towards its roots in a progressive agenda versus the neoliberalism that is currently being advocated?
Well, I would say to Ben that I reject the dichotomy between a progressive economic agenda, seizing back that economic populist ground from the right, and an acknowledgement that the way in which economic inequality plays out in the U.S. economy, has always been entirely inextricable from racial hierarchy and gender hierarchy, dating back to the creation of the U.S. economy on the backs of stolen African people and stolen indigenous land, which required the creation of scientific racism and theories that created a hierarchy of humanity that justified those terrible, terrible abuses and thefts. And
I can hear somebody like a Republican in Louisiana saying, yeah, that's history. That's way behind
us.
What do we need?
Sure. So let's talk about something more recent, what we were talking about earlier, the way in which attacks on the social safety net in this country have relied on using race as a wedge, systematically, going back to, older then, but in the neoliberal period, Reagan's creation of this mythology of the welfare queen. And now Jeff Sessions out there saying that the reason why Chicago and New York's infrastructure is overburdened is because immigrants are using it. I was recently in Portland, this is a city that is still traumatized by the stabbings on the MAX train, on the light rail train, by a white supremacist less than a month ago. You know what? It's interesting what he said to the young women of color who he was harassing on the train. In addition to saying, go back to where you came from and all of these other slurs, he said, get off the bus. You don't pay taxes. Right. So this is he had that talking point straight up.
This is Joan Williams' book again. I mean, she's talking about a working class, which is really the middle class, say income of 40 to 140,000. And they say, look, the helper subsidies to the poor and they're getting all this sort of thing. And we have to struggle. We have to keep our jobs and they're not
but
working.
But the solution is not to silence so-called identity politics. It is to tell a coherent and compelling story about how the politics of division, of racial division, of ethnic division, religious division, have been systematically used throughout U.S. history.
You mean use the narrative in the proper way and in the way that really serves the citizenry.
That brings people together in a multiracial coalition.
Well, let me read another comment. This is from Mason, who says, the anti-war left has not had a voice since George W. Bush's presidency. Is there any hope in the left unifying behind an anti-interventionist message in an era so fearful of lone wolf terrorism? system. Are there historical analogies where lessons can be learned, such as British parties that desire to see the removal of troops from Northern Ireland during the Troubles?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the anti-war movement that has been, that sort of demobilized after Bush.
We're talking about Iraq?
Yeah. I mean, during the Bush years, there was an incredibly strong anti-war movement, anti-torture movement in this country and around the world. And unfortunately, it's largely dispersed. I mean, there are still lots of wonderful people who are working on these issues, but it isn't a mass movement anymore. And, one of the things that worries me most about Trump is the way he uses violence to change the subject. And let's remember that he got his most favorable media coverage after he ordered that Syrian missile strike over delicious chocolate cake at Mar-a-Lago, by his own account.
Was that Trump chocolate cake?
That was presidential. Trump TM branded chocolate cake, yeah.
Let's bring in another caller. Again, our guest is Naomi Klein. Her new book is No Is Not Enough. And Rich joins us. Rich, you're on.
Hi. My comment is, instead of only worrying about how the Democrats lost and what caused them to lose, why not try and change the Republican Party, those in the Republican Party? Because not everybody was 100% behind Bush in the Republican Party. There's a lot of room there to change thought. And really, that's really what you want. It doesn't matter if it's the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. You want to change the entire thought of the entire country.
Well, change in the GOP, Naomi Klein?
Well, the GOP, I think, is, although there was a lot of resistance, and I think there is a significant Never Trump a portion of Democratic voters who can be appealed to. My concern is that the power brokers in the Republican Party are benefiting so much from Trump's endless showmanship and distraction and scandals by pushing through their wish list of hardcore so-called free market policies that they are not going to be inclined to rock the boat until Trump starts losing his base. Personally, I think that where we have a chance of having the most influence is, I'm going to leave it to others to try to change the Republican Party. I think where we may have more influence is in answering this question of why the Democrats lost this election, because I don't think Trump won it. I agree with Bernie Sanders that the Democrats lost it, and the numbers show it in depressed voter turnout. Trump did not win by a landslide in some fantastic mandate.
Well, he won by electoral college, too. I mean, he actually lost in the popular vote by millions. But here's a comment from a listener who says, I'd like to know, is there a chance in the American political system to give birth to a new party that is more centrist and can lean center left or right on a policy basis?
More centrist. Look, I think that the Democrats have been pretty centrist and been using that strategy for a while. I think the center's pretty crowded.
And we'll get another caller on here, and that's you, Greg. Join us. Welcome.
Marty, it's really funny to listen to this conversation. You're definitely going on about, wondering why Trump won, but yet the word jobs, small businesses, better schools, and all these things have never come up. And it's like, you're still not getting it. These people that live in these bubble coastal cities, it's not the rest of the United States. It's like the rest of the United States is suffering. And, we're all for better, immigrants' rights and all these other great things. But let's talk about our neighbors who are suffering, who need jobs, who are unable to get small business loans.
Yeah, Greg, I think you're bringing up an important point. We got a little bit of time left, so I want to get Naomi on this, not only about jobs, but entrepreneurial potentials and, the sort of thing that that people in the heartland really need. They got an opiate epidemic, which is just getting worse all the time.
Not just in the heartland. There is a jobs crisis. Whether the jobs may be there, but jobs are not paying a living wage. People can't afford to live in cities like this one. They are being pushed out. What I argue for in the book is seizing the crisis, the multiple overlapping crises that we face, climate change, economic inequality, racial injustice, and coming up with a coherent agenda that has a 21st century jobs revolution at its center, because we need to transform our economy on a deadline. We need massive investments in renewable energy, in energy efficiency, in public transit. We can create 10 times more jobs if we take climate change seriously than if we keep investing in fossil fuels, which are not major job creators. And we need to fight to make sure that those jobs are unionized, that they pay a living wage, because it isn't just any old job that people need. What they want are jobs that they can support families with, and also maybe even have a little bit of free time. This is what the whole final section of the book is about, is, you know, what is the framework through which we build a fairer economy and connect the dots between all of these overlapping crises. That's the task of our time.
A quick final question, and this comes from a listener named Dan. He says, where are the Democrats on giving us a solution to overhauling Obamacare? Seems like a good time for them to put on a sane alternative. Even if they can't pass it, they can claim the high road in the 2018 midterm. Quick response.
Well, look, I think a lot of people are looking at what is happening in California and the fact that the Senate has gone taken one step closer to single payer. And this is, you know, what we were talking about earlier in terms of, you know, as things get more and more dangerous at the federal level, it creates space and opportunities at the subnational and at the local level to step up and build the alternatives. And I think that, you know, that it is important to introduce a single payer at the national level, but we know that's not going to get through right now. But at the state level, it actually could. And that's incredibly exciting. And this is the way it usually starts. I'm Canadian. We want it at the provincial level, and then we want it nationally.
Always good to see you. Naomi, thank you for being with us.
Great to see you.
Naomi Klein, again, the book is No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. And you need to be with us for another hour, because we're going to be with you for another hour. We're going to talk in the hour ahead about the Georgia election and the outcome of it. But we're also going to talk about the firing or the resignation, depending how you see it, of the head of Uber. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.